Case number 12-5290, Ronnie Leroy Howard, appellant versus Caulfield, warden and United States Parole Board. Ms. Dyer for the appellant, Ms. Kelly for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Ronnie Howard. With the court's permission, I would like to begin by reading a statement that Mr. Howard has written in support of his pro se claims. Petitioner was summoned to a revocation hearing June 6, 1985, which satisfied the execution of the warrant according to Rule 4 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Petitioner received a 60-month violator term to run concurrently with his state sentence and was released on parole from the detainer slash warrant against him on July 21, 1987. The violator warrant was mistakenly requested to be executed, but was recalled by the Commission on July 25, 1987. The U.S. District Court erred when it confirmed that the U.S. Marshals had authority to make an arrest on July 27, 1987 with a recalled warrant, so that the violator term would start on July 21, 1987 instead of July 2, 1982, the date the 60-month violator term began. No legal authority supports this action. According to Maslauskas versus the United States Board of Parole, 639 F. 2nd, 935 from the Third Circuit in 1980. Thank you. That concludes my petitioner's pro se statement.
You're going to enter that in the record.
Excuse me?
Are you going to enter that into the record?
I will do that shortly, later today. Thank you. With respect to the arguments with which Mr. Howard is represented by counsel, this court should not rewrite what is effectively a five-year sentencing order by the Parole Commission, which states that Mr. Howard would be paroled from the violator term after the service of 60 months to the unexpired portion, remaining portion of his federal term. The order states that not once but twice, and it sets the violator term at 6,000.
Ms. Dyer, why wouldn't we give deference to the Commission for an interpretation of its own order? We do that all the time.
Well, the interpretation of its order came up in this litigation. Before this, the Commission simply implemented its order in its benefit, and we don't know. The Commission appears to agree, or respondents appear to agree, that the Commission is required to exercise discretion in each individual case with respect to concurrent and consecutive time, and we don't know what happened in 1986 because the record doesn't show us that. So the Commission's later implementation of this order doesn't show its reasoning. It doesn't show any basis for that interpretation. And in my view,
Am I not right, though, that the Commission, it's consistent with the Commission's policy to interpret these?
It is, but if the Commission is required to exercise discretion, the fact that it is its policy to do so, to deny concurrent time in similar cases doesn't establish that it did so here. And what it says now, it did then, or even what it says now that it intended then, does not establish what it did in fact intend at that time. So I would argue that.
The strength of your case is built on meaning the word from, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And from does not have any other meanings in this context that I can discern, and possibly in any context.
Can you just walk us through your reading of those three sentences, which I do find rather confusing. I think I understand how the government reads them, and I'd like to understand how you read them to require or contemplate that his time served in Virginia would count against his federal parole.
I would first of all, I don't think that the unexpired portion of the federal sentence is defined, and so it's not clear to me that that is the entire remaining violator term. That's a portion of what is left. So I'm starting with the second sentence, and this is the appendix at page 83.
Yeah.
The unexpired portion of your federal sentence shall commence upon your release from state custody or federal parole to your state sentence, whichever comes first. Continue to a presumptive parole
upon federal re-parole to your state sentence means what in your view?
That's what happened in this case. After 60 months, Mr. Howard was effectively on federal parole.
Right, but he says 60 months, it shouldn't have been after 60. Or
well, the 60-month was part of what I would argue of his federal term. So the 60 from the violator term meant from this a portion of the of what is later defined as the violator term after the service of 60 months. So what it is implementing is that I think in both parties' purposes is that if the state were to reparole Mr. Howard before that 60-month time period or at any time after it, for federal purposes he would not be detained. He would be effectively on parole after 60 months. So the only argument, what we differ on is what is the effect of that 60-month period. We do, it appears, agree that the violator term is the federal sentence. So where the order states violator term, it means federal sentence, not state sentence, and not what the commission or respondents define later as something called parole guidelines credit. That is not used anywhere in Mr. Howard's record. And so it's certainly not apparent from this order. I would also like to argue that even if this order is ambiguous in some sense or inconsistent or contradictory, that parolees should have some basic right to rely on plain language of orders, on a reasonable interpretation of those orders. And so the meaning of from the violator term, it's very hard to ascertain what that might otherwise mean, except that the 60-month period is part of the violator term.
If it's ambiguous, and you say we ought to defer to the parolee's interpretation?
No, not a subjective interpretation. I think that there should be a fundamental fairness right of parolees to, when they receive orders such as this, be able to rely on an objectively reasonable interpretation of those orders. And so that would be my argument.
In light of the commission's policies?
I think that the parolee is entitled to an individual decision on concurrent and consecutive time.
No, but you're talking about a right to rely on an objectively reasonable interpretation.
Of a revocation order.
So don't you have to consider what the commission's policies are?
Well, the commission's policies may indicate what the commission typically does, but if the commission is required to exercise individual discretion, then the question is, what did it do in this case? Were there either unusual circumstances? Were there any? We don't know. That's not in the record, but it is not established what the commission what discretion the commission exercised except through this order. This order is
What about the 1987 parole certificate?
That's 18 months later, and in that those 18
you
months...
Recognize, I mean, you acknowledge that clearly has in mind 17 years from 1987.
Well, that is a little bit unclear to a reasonable parolee as well, because it says to the concurrent state sentence. It doesn't say to the partially concurrent state sentence on the parole certificate, but it does calculate the end date.
I'm saying said prisoner be paroled on July 21, 1987, and that said prisoners to remain within the limits of the Eastern District of Virginia until October 2004.
The October 2004 is the one place where that order, the order of parole, does suggest that the commission is interpreting the time,
suggest?
The 6 months to be
consecutive. Suggests?
In Mr. Howard's earlier orders, parole certificates that he received numbers of days. So he received the 6,278-day marker.
Yeah,
and so, you know, at the time he received this, he was still in Buckingham Prison, and he didn't pay attention to that, according to what he testified. And so, he was not accustomed to the calculation of this particular end date to his sentence. And he didn't...
But in terms of showing what the commission, was interpreting
I think that shows that at least as of 1987, mid 1987, 18 months later, the commission interpreted its order one way and implemented its order one way. I wouldn't say interpreted because it doesn't have any sort of basis for that interpretation. in terms of interpreting the 1986 order. And with respect to the 2002 arrest, it does appear that the respondents agree that the 1988 warrant was executed in 2002. They simply argue that it was unofficial or invalid. And I think that, first of all, the record is not clear that it was, in fact, executed contrary to commission instructions, because there is not sufficient record evidence to find that Mr. Howard was actually released on bond in October of 2002. But second, at the evidentiary hearing, Respondents Exhibit E stated that the warrant should have been held as a detainer, not that it was held as a detainer. So it suggests that the warrant was executed, as respondents apparently agree, but nothing else then happened in 2002. And if that is the case, then there was at least a two-year period in which he did not receive a revocation. Well,
does this make a difference, given that in 2011 they reduced his sentence by 6 years?
I argue that they could have done something more lenient for him. In fact, they might have not revoked his parole. And I think that in addition to our prejudice arguments about certain witnesses that he would have called, which included his mother, Ms. Gaskins, and his parole officer.
Did he ever tell, is it on the record that he asked them and that they didn't show up?
It's on the record that he wanted witnesses at a local hearing, and that he was not given a local hearing. He identified some other witnesses. He did not identify these witnesses. But I do think that I would just like to add that I think that the record, despite the statistics of the numbers of arrests that he had, and this is in our briefs, but I would just like to underscore that his case is not as egregious as those statistics might make him sound. All of the offenses were for possession of simple possession of drugs and possession of a concealed knife, and we don't know what kind of knife that was. And Mr. Howard was, in fact, an admitted drug user, a Vietnam vet who suffered from Agent Orange in exposure and post-traumatic stress. And so I think that looking at his entire record and the fact that his parole officer in 1998 and 1999 and up to close to 2000 wanted to terminate his parole and sought the commission's permission to do that suggests that Mr. Howard's case is not quite as egregious as the sheer numbers of arrests might make.
On the 1998 warrant, the magistrate judge found that the government properly executed that warrant only once in 2004. What gives us the latitude to review that here?
Well, respondents at the evidentiary hearing admitted that it was executed and that it should have been held as a detainer instead into 2002. And they don't appear to counter that, or they appear to maintain that position in their appellate briefs. And if that's the case,
you mean it should have been held as a detainer until 2004?
It was executed in October 2002, and then apparently again executed in 2004. I'm not sure quite how that works, but he was in fact arrested and in the United States Marshal's custody in 2002 for some period of time. I'm not sure if that was overnight or in the course of one day, so that he was in federal custody at some time. In 2002, and I think that based on the respondent's position at the evidentiary hearing, we would argue that there was, in fact, an execution. With that, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Here, Your Honors, the district court didn't err in denying appellant's claim for habeas relief. The parole commission has correctly calculated the full-term date of Mr. Howard's original federal sentence in this case, and in doing so, it correctly calculated that the first 60 months that Mr. Howard spent in Virginia custody starting in July of 1982 did not count towards his violator term, towards the expiration of his time on parole from his original federal sentence. The court should give deference to the interpretation of the 1986 notice of action in this case. It's based on the actual language of the 1986 notice of action, it established that Mr. Howard's violator term, meaning the time that was left on his parole under his federal sentence, wouldn't begin to run again until he'd served the first 60 months of the Virginia sentence. When you read that entire document in context, we believe it does become clear that the first 60 months of his time in Virginia didn't count towards his completion of parole. Rather,
just,
it only
just counted. Just so I'm clear, this notice is prepared for what purpose?
It's to notify, to explain what the commission's decision has been in regard to the parole revocation matter that was before.
It's to explain to the defendant.
To the defendant, and also to make a record of the decision on whether to revoke probation
and
what sentence to
in
give.
In explaining this, you said which means, and I just wanted to know, how do we know that that's what it means?
We'd focus mainly on the first paragraph that states that the unexpired portion of your federal sentence shall commence upon your release from state custody or upon federal reparole to your state sentence, whichever comes first. And then it continues on to say, continue to a presumptive parole from the violator term after the service of 60 months, and then in parentheses, July 1st, 1987.
So does that mean that this assumes good behavior?
That would assume everything else goes smoothly, yes. So from this time that we're putting out this notice of action in 1986, if everything goes smoothly, you'll be paroled.
So in terms of notice to him, you're saying the 1985 revocation told him about the 17 years. This told him that term would not start to run until after the 60 months.
That's correct. He had a revocation hearing in June of 1985, and this notice of action that was issued in January 1986 documents the conclusion that was reached by the parole commission based on that hearing.
The hearing said somewhere 17 years, right, was remaining?
I believe there was a mention that he had 17 years left on his parole at that time. I can't remember exactly, but ultimately it's this notice of action that is the final say of the parole commission as to what to do with that 1985 hearing.
How typical is this language?
It's rather typical. It comports with the regulations that the parole commission has set forth, particularly 28 CFR 2.52C, which says that if you have criminal convictions while you're out on parole that are punishable by any term of imprisonment, that it's going to be an automatic statutory penalty that you forfeit time from the time that you were first released on parole until the execution of a warrant. And that time is not going to be credited to the service of your violator term.
So the thought is what? Everybody knows that unless the commission takes an unusual step, state time does not deduct from your federal time.
In part, and they are making an individual determination in each case.
I know it's individual, but that's the lay of the land unless the commission does something different.
Well, I would say it's the lay of the land. No, because here the Virginia sentence that he received for his Virginia offenses was actually a sentence that took him through 1992 in state custody. So it was really only the first 5 years of that lengthy Virginia custody that was counted as not being part of his time on parole.
That's the 60-month, and that's under a guideline that, 48 to 60 months?
That's correct.
Would typically be subtracted off of what would otherwise get counted concurrently as part of your federal parole, but
that's
because of the violation.
That's correct.
That's
essentially
the guideline.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's the guideline.
That's the guideline. They have a system of guidelines for whatever your particular offense on what your parole violation is, and they're weighing those. There's a whole system set up within the regulations as to the severity of the offense that you may have committed, what your individual characteristics are, and so forth. So they're making an individualized decision in that case.
But my question was a little bit different. You answered that this is consistent with 28 CFR 2.52C. Mm-hmm. My question was, is expressing it in this kind of language, which frankly I find highly opaque, to the offender is this typically the way an offender learns how his federal and state sentences are being calculated?
It, based on the documentation I've seen in this case, it appears that that is
the case. Typical in this case, typical in other cases?
The notice of action is the way that an offender learns of the decision.
And a notice of action is typically written with this kind of federal re-parole to your state sentence, prompted result from the violator term, which, in common English, doesn't scan very clearly. I know you all are dealing with this a lot more frequently than probably Mr. Howard was, but
it's my understanding that it would be language along these lines, yes. It's rather legalese, certainly. I would recognize that, Your Honor.
Do they get a chart?
If they're in a federal prison, there is the Bureau of Prisons calculates what their time is and so forth, and they also get.
But does the defendant get a copy of that?
The defendant does get information about what his time is and how it's calculated.
Does he get a copy of the chart?
I don't know if he gets a copy of the chart or not, Your Honor.
Does he get anything that's expressed more clearly than this?
Well, he certainly gets the parole certificate, which he did receive in this case in 1987. And I think it's very important to note here, and we put the document, it was a letter from Mr. Howard that he sent to his probation officer in April 15th, 1987, which is before he was re-paroled on July 21st. And he specifically showing his understanding that he was given a presumptive parole date of July 1st, 1987. And so it's, you know, although that, you know, the court may find the notice of action opaque, it's very clear that Mr. Howard himself did understand that he wasn't going to get credit for being on parole, you know, under his federal case again until July of 1987.
Where is that letter?
It's in the government's supplemental appendix.
All right.
But so that letter is doesn't clarify whether the prior 5 years would be counted or not. It's really equivocal on that basic question, which is the disputed issue here.
Well, an understanding of the term presumptive parole is that you're not going to be on parole again until that date has passed here, July 1987.
Well, that could be presumptive parole by operation of law, but there could be, you know, counting when he's in Virginia prison before that, which is what I understand at least Mr. Howard.
Well, that's what Mr. Howard is saying in this case. He was not saying that in April of 1987. He was recognizing that he was not on federal parole at that time, is the point of our letter. And certainly to deny that portion of time at the beginning of his Virginia sentence is in keeping with the Parole Commission's policy under the regulations. In keeping with the case law that we've cited in our brief, the Byrd case, for instance, the D'Amato case, and so forth.
All right, so the rest of this notice of action, if you go further down the page, it refers specifically to the federal parole violator term is 6,278.
And that's days, Your Honor.
Presumably. I mean, it's not written there, but I totally agree with you, but I'm just saying it's not there.
It's not written there, although it does say just before that.
Days
no, it does.
Owed.
It says the number of days owed on federal parole violator term is 6,278.
So he knows from this paragraph what that first paragraph means.
That's correct. And if you
is that the government's position?
It is, and if you look at the about two lines above the line that Your Honor has just quoted, it says if you're still in state custody as of the above date, which would be the July 1st, 1987, then you'll have presumptive parole from the violator term to your state sentence, and then you have 6,200 and some days running from there on out.
Right.
And further down, then, the notice of action is saying that you're in this range of 48 to 60 months to be served before re-release, which is re-release onto federal parole again, and ultimately they had decided in the first paragraph that he was going to serve 60 months and that he'd already served at the time of this notice, which was January of 1986, he'd already served 35 months towards that 60 months at that point.
So I'm not trying to make your argument, but I just want to be clear. It's that paragraph that explicates what is the somewhat garbled language in the first paragraph, which is tracking the regulation?
That's correct. It's that first paragraph and then the discussion that's under the double line after charge four through that. And based on that language in and of itself, plus the regulations that the Parole Commission has put in place for what happens when you've committed criminal offenses while you're on parole, and the case law, we would say that the Commission, not only in this litigation, but from day one in Mr. Howard's case, has been saying that he was going to be essentially re-paroled in July of 1987. That position is not something that just came up in this litigation. It's been that permanently.
So is it your position that given this notice, he was fully aware of the time he faced and that any mix-up regarding execution of these federal warrants really cannot be harmless almost in any circumstances because the federal government would still have the right to take him into custody, to require him to serve the remainder of time, absent the commission exercising its discretion to reduce that time along the lines of the almost 6 years it did?
I believe that this is a different question. The 6 years was in relation to what happened in the execution
statement. I'm trying to understand this case.
In this case, yes.
And I read this paragraph, and there's a lot of chatter about problems with the execution of warrants, problems with whether the detainer was lodged. But he has this time he owes the federal government, and whether it starts on day one or day 10, when these executions and detainers are finally put in proper order, he still has to serve the time. I understand his position to be that the failure to get this in order means that his time, A, was going anyway. Mm-hmm. It was running. There was no tolling, in effect. And then secondly, had the hearing been earlier, then he would have been in a better position to have made some of these arguments such that he might have been released earlier.
Okay,
is that your understanding of the case?
That's my understanding of his argument. That's not my understanding of the case.
The case he has presented.
It's my understanding of the case that he has presented. We just don't agree with it. First of all, the issue of him being re-paroled in 1987 is one issue.
I'm trying to look at this as an overview, right, just so I can understand where the details fit in.
Right, the big
because
picture.
It's almost mind-boggling reading this record, all right? So that's all I want to be clear on.
Right. And if, in 1992, he was released from custody in Virginia.
Right.
And he then committed further violations of parole by committing new criminal offenses, five of which his parole was revoked for in December of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, what happened in 1987 and his re-parole time starting, on July 21st, 1987, those 6,278 days started to run again, up to the point that he committed further criminal violations in the 1990s and through 2002, I believe, and those later violations resulted in, as the magistrate court found, one execution of a parole warrant, which occurred on August 11th, 2004. We don't agree that 1998 warrant that was hanging out there in abeyance for a period of time was, in fact, executed in October of 2002.
How was he taken into custody in 2002 if not on that warrant?
He was taken into custody and was immediately turned over to Arlington County, Virginia, for local charges to be brought against him. And in the record, where this was litigated in front of the National Appeals Board, the National Appeals Board was saying that the 1998 warrant was lodged as a detainer on October 22nd, 2002. That's at pages A338 and 339, which is essentially rejecting the defendant's claim that his December 2004 revocation hearing was outside, too late, essentially. That matched up with Mr. Husk's testimony at the hearing, where he was saying that the commission didn't execute the 1998 warrant until August 11th, 2004. That was on May 11th in the afternoon at page 44. And ultimately, we believe that's correct. The district court also correctly found in this case that that 1998 warrant was only lodged as a detainer on October 22nd, 2002. And that's at page A670 of the district court's magistrate judge's report and recommendation. And those decisions by the district court were, in fact, reasonable, that it was not executed until August 11th, 2004. And ultimately, the district court decided what's really most important is that having that next revocation hearing in December of 2004 did not prejudice Mr. Howard, because ultimately the fact that his mother may have been able to testify earlier, or the crux of all that testimony was known to the hearing officer in 2004, through other means. And ultimately, his violations, for which his parole was revoked in December of 2004, were based on convictions, criminal convictions, which under the regulation 2.52C would automatically result in his parole being revoked. So whether his mother was able to say that he was trying his best while on release really would not have made a decision here, since the regulations would ultimately be in place saying that because of those violations, your parole is revoked.
May I ask you a question about the process? And I apologize for not following this completely, but so there's an argument about whether the 1982 warrant was properly executed in July of 1987. There's an argument about that. That's not my question. My question is, why do we care about that? Didn't he had the parole revocation hearing. Why doesn't that answer that question?
Well, I mean, he's not saying that it was never executed at that date. There was a question in Mr. Howard's mind, if I understand it correctly, is whether or not it was executed on July 21st, 87, or July 27th or 25th. Ultimately, the parole commission, it's clear in the record, started as of July 21st, 1987, counting those 6,278 days in Mr. Howard's favor, getting him closer to being off parole, starting on July 21st, 1987.
Let's just take a hypothetical. Mm-hmm. He's sentenced federally. He's released on parole. He's arrested in Virginia. He's sentenced and he's released by Virginia. 10 years passes. Mm-hmm. And finally, the federal government executes its parole violator warrant. In this hypothetical, would there be any prejudice to the defendant were his hearing after this 10-year period where he's been a free man in the community?
I don't believe that he would be prejudiced by that, because under the regulations by the Parole Commission, that new criminal conviction in Virginia would be the basis for revoking his parole, period.
It's the 10 years of freedom I'm focusing on.
Right.
The implication of the question is, it does matter, unless you're going to take the position that the fact he's been a free man, as it were, conducting his life for 10 years, and all of a sudden an officer knocks on his front door and says, we're taking you into custody. Mm-hmm. Now, he hasn't absconded, so it's not that type of case.
Right.
He's
right.
Living openly in the community. His parole officer knows exactly where he lives and works. So it's not that type of case. I'm just trying to understand, pushing you as far as I can, to just understand it. Is the government's position it just doesn't matter? You owe the time, and the fact that we're late doesn't matter.
My understanding of it is that the due process concerns don't kick in until the execution of the warrant. And it's at that point that you start questioning, did you get a timely hearing or a quick hearing. There's a 90-day rule under the statute. So we would say no, and because the parolee is going to still have an individualized hearing where they can look at what was your criminal history, what's your actual violation in this case, and how did you act for the last 10 years while you were out? That can all still be taken into consideration at the revocation hearing ultimately. So I wouldn't say as a blanket rule that that would be, for instance, a due process violation.
I didn't frame it as a due process argument. I'm just trying to understand the procedures here.
The hearing would occur, and the important part of that hearing would be that he would have individualized attention as to what his actual behavior was in this case. And one other point I had forgotten to make, Your Honors, about the prejudice in this case. Even if his mother couldn't testify in person at the hearing, Mr. Howard would be allowed to provide written statements from people that he wanted to testify on his behalf at the revocation hearing as well. So there really isn't any prejudice given the nature of his violations, most of which he admitted in the December 2004 hearing, and the fact that that testimony, anything his mother wanted to say, could be put in front of the commission at the hearing in another means. And in fact, the crux of that testimony that he'd been trying to better his life through drug rehabilitation was in fact in front of the hearing officer at that hearing.
What about the claim that Mr. Howard makes about trying to find witnesses who could testify about the practice of holding warrants as detainers, who's executing them multiple times? I mean, he's really trying to understand what happened in this case. And as I read it, he's really basically doing kind of a 30B6 kind of, you know, deposition. Says just produce somebody who can explain to me what the practice was about when a warrant is executed and when it's not. And that was denied, and he claims that's error. What's your response?
Right. It's not error. First of all, he never placed any of these people on a witness list to begin with. It was only during the hearing that he said, and this only goes to whether or not that 1982 parole warrant was executed in July of 1987 and on what date. That was the issue. He wanted to call the deputy marshal who signed the warrant return and an administrative clerk who was on a telex and so forth. And his counsel said at the hearing that these people may not recall these documents from the 1980s and that maybe they can speak to the customary practices in the 1980s, but there was no showing that they had relevant or probative information. And in fact, they were given an additional day to go back and see if they could contact any of these people. Two of them, Ms. Ward and Ms. Cowles, had no recollection, and the other two, Mr. Williams and Mr. Clark, couldn't be located. And at that point, the appellant didn't seek any further relief.
Right, so it's his error in failing to frame it as sort of a 30B6, produce someone that can explain this to me.
Right. And ultimately, it was just that these people that he wanted to call, when they did make the calls and so forth during and that overnight period, they didn't come up with any further information that would indicate that these witnesses would have had relevant evidence to impart. They either couldn't be found or they didn't recall the case. And there's certainly, even after Mr. Howard challenged the report and recommendation by the magistrate to the district court, never was able to show how those witnesses might be competent to testify about customary procedures during the 1980s, even after his evidentiary hearing here. So I thought it was notable that the appellant here didn't really just the argument that was made in the briefs was that maybe if the government had been ordered to locate these people, that they would have been more successful than we were. And that still is just very speculative. The government had said at the time they didn't have any more information.
Well, that's why I'm referring to 30B6. I mean, there is a mechanism that addresses precisely this kind of problem, which is actually the government, I mean, he's right? Actually, it is the government who should know who in its employ understands these processes. And he shouldn't have to sort of, you know, guess at who's going to remember and who was working at the time. He wants an accounting from the government about a set of processes that he was subjected to. And
right.
That's actually something that the federal rules recognizes and typically makes available. And he just, you know, he didn't know that.
And Mr. Howard, the government presented Mr. Husk, who explained how the procedure worked and explained what had happened in Mr. Husk had reviewed all the documents in this case and had been able to testify as to what happened. We don't believe that there's anything additional, and he's really not saying here that had these people been brought in, that these people would, in fact, have had information to impart that was relevant. So based on the position that the magistrate judge was in at the time of the hearing, there was absolutely no abuse of discretion in her saying that there's no information to say that these people had relevant or probative information, and we're going to continue on with the hearing. So for all of these reasons, we respectfully request that the district court's order be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
I just have a couple of points. First, the respondents do agree that the commission does have to make an individual determination whether to impose concurrent or consecutive sentences. There is not a guideline that it will definitely be consecutive. There's no ironclad rule. The defendant does not get a copy of his chart or his computation of sentence in a state facility. And in this case, Mr. Howard testified, he not only did not have any federal computation of his sentence for the remainder of his term in Buckingham, he did not even have a copy of the commission's 1986 order. All he had was his certificate of parole. And he had been told in the 1985 hearing, and that was in the hearing as well as after by his attorney, that the sentence would be concurrent, the 60-month sentence. With respect to the 2002 arrest, it was not immediate. He was taken to Alexandria by the marshals for some period of time before he was turned over to the state. So he was in sole federal custody for some period of time, according to his testimony, and that's repeated in his repeated letters to the commission and the BOP to try and get someone to attend to this once he realized after 1989 that his sentence was not over. I would just like to point out again to the court that Steve Husk had no personal knowledge of the facts in this case. All of his testimony was based on an interpretation of the record, of the papers in this case, that everyone else can look at and read and interpret. With respect to the, going back for a minute to the 1986 order, respondents said a couple of times, well, he knew that he was going to be paroled on July 21st or July 1st, originally 1987, and so therefore he must have known that the sentences were consecutive. That knowledge didn't show that he knew that they were consecutive. And so a letter saying he recognizes that he will be paroled at that time doesn't mean he's still thinking that the 60 months will be credited to his federal sentence. With respect to the witnesses that he was unable to find, we did not, in fact, contact Ms. Cowles. It was only Ms. Ward that our office was able to speak to. When the court gave us additional time to try and find them, it was for both parties to work together to try to find them, and that was unsuccessful. I think it's clear that those witnesses would have been more competent to testify about standard practices and procedures in 1987 with respect to how warrants are handled than anybody who never worked for the commission in that time period. And with that, I believe that if the court has no further questions, I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.